I'm talking today with Mr. Ralph Harry, who is a present director of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and who was a student at the University of Tasmania from 1935 till 1938. Now, before we embark on the 1934-5 period, can you tell me, Mr. Harry, what you've been doing since then?
Well, immediately I left Tasmania, I went to Oxford, and straight from Oxford into Australia's new diplomatic service in 1940. I learnt the trade a little in Australia and then went to Canada to our High Commission in Ottawa in 1943, and then a succession of diplomatic posts with intervals in Australia. I served in Washington, in New York, in our mission to the UN, subsequently in Geneva as a permanent representative to the European headquarters of the United Nations, then in Singapore, and later, after a fairly long spell in Australia, in Belgium, both with the Belgian government and the European communities, then as ambassador in Saigon to the Republic of Vietnam, and from then, after another spell in Australia, as ambassador in Bonn, and finally Australian ambassador to the United Nations, which was my last posting. And after I retired for a few weeks, I was in the University of Tasmania again as a visiting fellow for the first term of this year, which was great fun. And now I have taken up this position as director of the Institute of International Affairs.
And you are a Tasmanian?
I was not born in Tasmania, but I migrated to Tasmania with my parents at the age of 6, and had my whole schooling and, of course, my first university experience in Tasmania. That was from 1923 to 1938.
I see, yes. Now, you say you went straight from the University of Tasmania to Oxford. How did that occur?
Well, I went as a Rhodes Scholar.
You were a Rhodes Scholar, yes.
At that period, that was practically the only way that an impecunious student could get to Oxford. And I may say that I had to work my way there as an assistant pantry boy on a cargo boat, the Port Fremantle. That's how I got to Oxford.
Well, that must have been quite an experience too.
Well, it was very interesting. I learned something of
life
and people in the course of 7 weeks at sea.
Yes. Well, now, can we go further back? You went to the university in 1935, but I'd like to hear whether your family was university-oriented, or whether you were the first member of your family to go to university, or can you tell me about the background a bit?
We were definitely a university family by this stage. My ancestors come from Cornwall and migrated to South Australia in the 50s. They were a mining family which had got a little education and went in for teaching. And I had teachers on both sides of the family. My grandfather then, my mother's side, went into politics and became a Member of Parliament in South Australia, subsequently Premier and then First Speaker of the Federal Parliament after Federation. But my mother went to the university in Adelaide and was, I think, the first woman to receive an MA at the University of Adelaide. My father was a teacher at Prince Alfred College and did his arts degree as a teacher. So they both had degrees, and they were, I think, determined that all my family, my brother and my two sisters should go to university. It was the natural thing for us to do if and when we could. My brother did a degree part-time in Hobart, working in the public service. My two sisters went to university on scholarships, but in those days those carried no living allowances, they just paid the fees. And I got a job at the height of the Depression, of course, in the public service, lucky to get a job at £87 a year with a local allowance, living away from home, to bring it to £93 a year. And then I did my law degree part-time. Most of my contemporaries in the law school earned their way through by being articled clerks, and they got a pittance in their first year and a slightly larger pittance in the subsequent years, but I had my salary from the Defence Department and the Ordnance Stores. Now in the arts faculty, and of course our first year of the law course in those days was a year of arts subjects, so we had compulsorily English history, that's English history, yes, and Latin.
Yes.
And then we had a choice for the fourth subject. Most of the law students did psychology, which was regarded as an easy subject to do. I had my eyes a bit on foreign service even then and did French as my fourth subject. But in the arts faculty, almost all the students were teachers in the teachers' college,
yes,
and doing subjects at the university. The teachers' college was close by, and that was the arrangement in 1935.
Yes. I've heard some people say that there was a division between people who were doing courses through the education department and people who weren't. Were you conscious of any kind of division there?
I really can't recall any division. Of course, we were aware of the teachers. They had other obligations. They had periods when they were away at practicing school and when they couldn't take part in the life of the university, the sporting and cultural and social activities. And this may have set them apart slightly, but they certainly took part.
They did take part
in all the activities, yes, debating and.
Yes. I thought perhaps they had their own separate sporting organisations and separate groupings, social and so on. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I think there were clubs at the Teachers College, but the students from the Teachers College certainly participated in the activities I was concerned with, like debating, the International Relations Club, the Student Christian Movement, and the sporting activities.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes, well, can we talk about some of those things?
Well, of course, it was difficult for part-time students who were doing their studies in the evening and were working during the day to have as full a social life or a cultural life as students as I found later at Oxford, for example. Nonetheless, there were many activities in the late afternoon and early evening, and these were quite active clubs and societies.
When would your lectures have been? What time of day?
Well, the law lectures were during the day, many of them. I was able to get time off from my office for that. In the arts faculty, the lectures tended to start around 5 o'clock and run through till, I suppose, to 7 o'clock. There may have been other lectures at other times, but this was the prime lecturing time, And then it was after that that we had meetings of the International Relations Club or the Debating Society and so on.
Just as a matter of curiosity, where did you eat if you were at the university in those crucial hours, dinner time?
You went back to your boarding house and you had your meal back at the boarding house where you got a full board for 22 shillings and sixpence a week. You didn't eat at any restaurant at the university. There wasn't such a thing. There was a union which consisted of a tin shed which had an office for the president of the union at one end of the shed and a largish barn where with a few chairs and tables, which was a common room, and that was the accommodation for the union. The life of the union was not in a building, but it was in the clubs and societies. And of course you had football club, rowing club, athletics, tennis, and you had all the different cultural activities, but no building whatever.
Now, were men and women, for instance, was this tin shed a men's union, or was that all veiled in the mists of
as I say,
the past?
I don't remember being in the shed or union much at all. That's somewhere where you went to see the president or secretary of the union about possible grant to send a debating team to Adelaide, or where you met somebody to arrange about a football match or something of that kind. It's not a place where you went to meet and talk.
Yes,
this was done in separate rooms. I mean, the meetings were held in lecture rooms, by and large.
Well, I'm really just getting at, were women as involved as men in the university, or were they a very small minority?
Women were very active in, for example, the debating society. The teams were mixed men and women debating in the... It was a literary and debating society, and women like Megan Griffiths and Joan Courtney Pratt were leading members of that society. In the student Christian movement, it was mixed men and women and complete equality. In Togatas, the university newspaper, the editor in my time was sometimes a woman, sometimes a man. I was editor myself for a period and then handed over, as I recall, to Megan Griffiths as editor. It may have been Maida Williams, but in the International Relations Club, for example, I recall my sister, Millicent Harry, was the secretary. We had in those days a professorial advisor or consultant for the International Relations Club. The president in that period was a man. In all of these societies, men and women were...
And were these societies ones that had been going on for some time, or were you involved in the initiation of any of them?
Now, I think the International Relations Club had been founded a few years before. I know it existed in 1934, when I used to be up around the university, although I had not yet started my course. I attended meetings up there, and I think it had existed for a few years. Togatas had been running for, I think, about 5 years at that stage. 1935 was volume 5, and in my period we did increase the size of Togatas and brought it out a little more frequently, and we acquired a few advertisements, and we sold it on the streets for the first time. That had never been done before.
How was Togatas financed? Was there a student levy of some sort, or was it the university?
Togatas was sold issue by issue, and we got a few advertisements. I have a copy in front of me, actually, and I find advertisements from Heathorn's Hotel, Oldham, Bedham and Meredith and Burroughs and Meek and from Kodak, Australasia. No, we went out and got advertisements and we sold to Gartus. I don't remember what the subscription was. We sold subscriptions for the year and we sold it in single copies. And the commemoration issue, which was a special, usually made quite a bit of money.
Yes.
But we may have had a grant of £10 to help us cover any loss. But there was not much money. The subscription to the union was very small in those days. It, from recollection, it would have been something like £3 a year. That was a lot of money. It would have been the equivalent of... equivalent of $120 today.
You'd never get anybody to pay $120 today, would you? Do they pay that sort of money? Anyway, never mind. That's beside the point.
The students had to pay their dues to the union in those days.
Yes. Now, you're talking about the International Relations Club, but... was there much political activity on the part of the students, by which I mean, were there any divisions into political camps, or were you not politically minded in that sense?
I don't recall any political clubs as such. There was a lot of political discussion at Christ College, for example, where I went for my last 3 years, 36, 7, 8. Very lively political discussion around the common room fire. Again, it was a small place, but the discussion was very lively. I saw Roy Fagan the other day, and we were recalling the political, philosophical and religious debates at Christ College, and they were very keen indeed. But in the university, the International Relations Club was more like the Institute of International Affairs today, a fairly serious study of events and international issues. But I do remember towards the end of my period, division over the Spanish Civil War, and there was lampooning of the Nazis, for example, but this was student lampooning in commemoration rather than an actual political division. But I think there was division over the issue of the Civil War in Spain. I recall two students coming back from Europe who had visited Czechoslovakia and had had contacts with Czech students, and they brought back to us the European division between the left wing and the Nazis in particular. But there was no active political club that I can recall in the university itself.
And can you recall any issues, be either local or any kind of issues that the students were roused about in that period?
Well,
in the state of the student union, for instance, or
politics within the student union were concerned mainly with which club would get finance for its activities, because there was a very limited pool of funds available, and very keen debate and lobbying to see which teams would get a grant to be able to participate in intervarsity sports and competitions. Intervarsity debating tended to be the Cinderella, as I think the football club had a more political punch. But I can't recall party political divisions within the student union at all in that period. Now, this doesn't mean to say that they weren't there, because I was a part-time student. My activities were with Tagatas, International Relations Club, Student Christian Movement. At this period I became an ardent internationalist, learnt the international language, Esperanto, and so on. So that I might just not have been involved in politics, but from a quick look at Tagatas in that period, there's no sign that that existed. There were left-wingers and liberationists, cynicals, atheists, radicals, but not many politicians. I'll tell you about Tagatas and its place.
Oh, that's right, yes, Tagatas.
We've talked perhaps enough about that, on how it was produced and sold and financed. But as to the content of Tagatas, that might be of interest. It was largely a record of student activities, reports from the clubs, reports of the annual meeting, of the Kamem procession, changes in personnel and so forth, but usually a serious editorial, some serious articles. The usual problem of editors and filling the space available, and some lively columns that developed. There was a certain Horatio Bluebaum, which was, I think, Geoffrey Redding, though they were never signed, and it was used as a vehicle for advertising events, the annual ball or what have you, and that was the form of the paper. It became at times controversial. We had, I see here, talking about politics, the parliamentary debate as a heading, but actually it was a debate between the faculties and not really a political debate. And I do recall that there was a student who submitted material to Tagatas which was refused, and who regarded this as discrimination or censorship or something, and started his own rival sheet at that time. That, of course, added a lot of life.
I can't recall what this sheet was called. It's probably disappeared from the annals.
No, I can't remember the name. This was Geoffrey Redding that I'm talking about. He subsequently became a journalist. But I can't remember the name that he gave to his sheet. I might recall it before we finish this interview.
Yes, good. You mentioned the SCM. Now, what was the, shall we say, the state of religion in the university then? Was the SCM flourishing? Were there many people who were anti-religious, or were most people conventional religious?
Well, I mentioned that there were cynics and atheists in Christ College. There was an ardent debate between the cynics who would support an atheistic position, chiefly, I suspect, to bait the religious students. We had at that stage a young Catholic, Peter Green, who became, I think, a Jesuit and a distinguished Jesuit. I was at that time an ardent Presbyterian, and there was a small Oxford Group movement in Australia, which was active in Tasmania, and some of us in the Student Christian Movement also became supporters of the Oxford group idea. This was before it was called moral rearmament, it subsequently became. I think there may have been a Catholic society, but the student Christian movement was a rather intellectual, philosophical, yes, religious, yes. But nonetheless fairly orthodox.
Was there also an evangelical union? In my day at the university there were these two groups, and one was much more fundamental,
yes.
But one had this intellectual, relatively speaking.
I believe there was an evangelical movement, but I don't think it was organized within the university at that time. I think that the student Christian movement was sufficiently evangelical to suit most,
yeah,
of the ardent Christians.
And can you recall any of the activities of the,
yeah,
SCM?
The typical activity of the SCM was the study group, which would, as I said, study Bible topics, philosophical aspects of religion, and the most popular activity, of course, was the conference, which was a friendly kind of rather hearty Christian camp at which you would have walks, social activities, lectures, discussion, sometimes up at the Springs, up on Mount Wellington, or down on Brunei Island at some holiday home, and or at Taruna, I think, for short weekends. This was very popular, and when we weren't having conferences, we would often have hikes with a few of the members.
Yeah.
That was also a typical activity of the,
yes, that's right. Yes.
The
a very
Christian
agreeable
students.
Combination of activities, including some of the sort of mating aspects as well. I think.
Well, indeed, I think that there were quite a lot of marriages grew out of the SCM. Not in my own case. I can't recall any in my period directly from the SCM. Another thing was, of course, that there was an all-Australian conference held annually on the mainland as a rule. I went over to a conference at Frensham at Mittagong, and these conferences gave an opportunity for contacts with other universities,
yes,
and those were also popular and gave a wider experience.
Yes. While we're touching on this question of student relations, can we talk about, for a moment, about just that very question? Because, I mean, now things are so different from the way they were in my day, a bit after yours, but not all that much. Were you sort of terribly aware of sex rearing its head in university days? I mean, were there many people who would have been, for instance, promiscuous or shopping around in a way that is so commonplace, I gather, nowadays?
I frankly don't know the extent to which there was promiscuity in the particular milieu in which I moved. This was not contemplated. We mated, as you said, principally by a process of Christian courtship and engagement, marriage. Divorce was much rarer in those days. We were aware of cases where there had been sex before marriage, illegitimate children or hasty marriages. This was something that we knew of but deplored. I don't know to what extent it took place or in other circles,
yes,
of the university.
Yes.
But I doubt whether it was frequent and common as it is today.
Yes, it is interesting, though, because I mean, I'm not aware that we felt repressed.
No, to us, it was normal. Normal life was study and sport, into university, boy meets girl, boy declares love, girl embraces boy, and I was not actually engaged myself while at university, but I did have an understanding which was subsequently became an engagement after the war, and which was subsequently broken off. That's not my present wife. I met her later, but I think that we didn't feel repressed. We had normal sexual urges. We set out, I think, to wait. Meanwhile, we had a lot of fun and dancing, and we knew what girls were.
Yes, quite so. And I have heard other people from this period, people like John May and Cynthia Alexander, talking about the kinds of expeditions up Mount Wellington or walks to Kingston Beach. Cynthia Alexander was saying they thought nothing of this kind of...
No, we would walk from the city up through the Cascades, up through Fern Tree Gully, right up to the springs.
Yes. That's right.
And back in the day.
We were just so healthy then.
I wish I was as fit now as I was then.
Did you ever have the feeling in Tasmania that you were trapped in Tasmania? Were you aware of it as an isolated and rather distant place that you found yourself in?
Not particularly. I mean, we were thinking about the world. We were reading. We had materials. We were interested when we got the opportunity to go over to the mainland, and as I said, we would go to student Christian movement conferences, to inter-varsity debating, to inter-varsity sport, football excursions, of ping pong competitions and so forth, and I also was given the opportunity to go to a conference in Canberra of the Institute of Political Science. One of the lecturers, Ken Dallas, I think, had a grant from somewhere. It may have been £10, but in those days that was enough to get you across to the mainland. And I got to this conference in Canberra. And there, for the first time, I had contact with people in the professions, trade union people, leaders of the community. And it gave me a fresh outlook. I would meet people coming from abroad to Tasmania. The Secretary of the Roads Trust, just before I left Hobart, Lord Lothian, I remember. And these people brought us insights into the outside world. We wanted to get to the big universities. The Rhodes Scholarship was very much prized.
Yes.
Fortunately, in Tasmania, there was not too much competition in that period. And I may mention this, that in my third year, Bob Baker, who was my rival in the law school, mentioned it to me one day that if we both stood for the Rhodes Scholarship the following year, one of us would get it and the other obviously wouldn't. And had I thought of standing in my third year, which was permitted. And after some reflection, I decided that I'd do that. So I got the scholarship that year, and he got it the following year. Both out of the law school.
Yes. But obviously regarded you as a serious rival.
I think he was glad that I was out of the way. I don't know who would have won if we'd stood together. But, I mean, we felt the need for personal experience in the big world. It wasn't so easy to get to Europe. People went on working holidays. In those days, of course, it was still the tail end of the Depression, and it wasn't easy to get employment, jobs anywhere. And I was regarded by my colleagues in the Defense Department ordnance stores as a madman, crackers, for giving up my job for my last year in Hobart. I had a few pounds saved up, and I quit my job, resigned from the public service to have a year full time. This was regarded as absolutely crazy, because you just didn't give up a job. It was too hard to get one. But I felt confident, knowing that I'd have a couple of years at Oxford, and after that the world might be my oyster.
Yes, yes. Well, now, some people have suggested that the University of Tasmania was, shall we say, third-rate university in the, well, even later 40s and 50s, and that some people were content that it should remain so, whereas other people wanted it raised to parity, and this included salary parity, which it didn't always have, I understand, with the other universities. Now, I want to get on to the question of your teachers and the standard of the university, but did you have any views about that at that stage?
I don't think we felt ourselves to be, in any sense, a third-rate university.
No, well,
we knew we were small, but we also had good professors, and our graduates seemed to be able to hold their own with anybody, anywhere. We were producing people like Roland Wilson and other the Rhodes Scholars who went to Oxford, usually got good honours degrees, second class sometimes, occasionally there'd be first class. Well, that is the normal pattern in Oxford. I think among the Rhodes Scholars, the Tasmanian scholars, held their own with scholars from other states.
Yes.
And the average graduates, I mean graduates from engineering, for example, included Knight, who designed the bridges of Tasmania and the Derwent floating bridge and other innovative things. We had graduates who devised means of converting the hardwood, the eucalypts, into paper pulp for newsprint. This research was being done in the university, and as I say, I don't think we had any sense of inferiority. We were able to compete in debating with the mainland universities. Sporting teams didn't have quite the same capacity. They had a smaller constituency. But the mainland universities were not so large in those days either. Getting back to the teachers, perhaps. We had as a teacher of classics, and I studied Latin. All the lawyers studied Latin under R.L. Dunbabin, who had, I think, a good international reputation. And, of course, our classes were seminars to a large degree. They were small. We could talk to the professor. If we didn't interrupt him during his lecture, we were able to ask questions at the end and see him and continue the discussion afterwards. Every professor knew all his students, and the students probably of the whole faculty. And Taylor, who taught us English, he had published, he had a good reputation. Treble, who taught us French, I think achieved subsequently a good reputation as a linguist. And of course Charles King was a fine historian. These were my four professors in the first year.
Yes.
And in economics you had people like L.F. Giblin and Malden. Great men.
Yes.
I think I have a private theory as to why they developed into great men, and that is because they became practical economists preparing the case for Tasmania. They were not just theoretical economists. They had to produce the facts and the arguments to get that grant from the Grants Commission. But Of the other faculties, I can't talk so directly. I think that we had some good scientists, engineers,
And what about lawyers.
The lawyers that were produced in that period include the people like Roy Fagan, Sir Peter Crisp, John Driscoll, Bob Chambers, who I think they all proved to be great lawyers. Bob Baker, as a lawyer, did well at Oxford and subsequently became a professor. Now, our professor of law was Ken Shatwell, who came after a brilliant career at Oxford, Lincoln College. He was a protege of Hanbury, the great equity lawyer and writer, and I think the law school got a boost in that period.
Yes.
It was a good period for the law school. He subsequently went on to be a professor in Sydney. He was a good professor. Then we had, that was supplemented by lecturers from the profession in Hobart.
Yes.
Men like Reg Wright, who was a fine lawyer and an expositor of the law, and we had Bob Osborne and other lecturers who taught us the tools, the trade subjects like property and contracts.
Yes. Oh, you obviously didn't feel at any disadvantage at all in this small and somewhat isolated university. Quite the contrary, but
I don't think we were any more isolated than the University of Melbourne or the University of Adelaide or the University of Queensland. We were closer to Melbourne than most of the other
Certainly.
Universities. We were not isolated to the extent that Western Australia is isolated. We could, particularly as air travel developed, we could be in Melbourne in an hour or so, and I say we did go to the mainland, a lot of us, quite frequently.
Yeah.
Even the penurious as we were, we managed to get over to the mainland.
Yeah.
And I doubt whether the Melbourne people had much more contact with Sydney than we would have had with Melbourne.
So, in fact, pursuing that line of thought, you might say that Tasmanians now could feel more isolated than they did then, because there is more in Melbourne and Sydney and Canberra. So now, perhaps...
Well, I just had a term as a visiting fellow in Hobart. I didn't sense any feeling of isolation in the university. The professors and lecturers there have a study leave and move about now to a quite extraordinary extent. They have. I don't know whether the professors in my time had sabbatical leaves.
I don't think they did.
I think they did manage to get some trips away, but I don't really know about that. But at the present time, I don't think they feel particularly isolated in Hobart.
Oh, no.
All they feel is that they should have more money from the government so that they can have longer and better sabbaticals and more study leaves and opportunity to go and talk to their colleagues in other universities. I think there is now more collaboration between specialists in the Australian universities than there was in our time, but it'd be hard to measure.
Yes.
What they have now is buildings, rooms for lecturers where they can have their own private working libraries, stenographic assistance to an extent undreamed of in our time, copying machines, larger libraries in my time. Of course, the whole university was up at the
yes.
Domain. Everything was up there. And the library was the only large room. It was a good little collection, but quite small by present-day standards. And of course it had to be cleared out for dances and gatherings. The Kamem was held in the town hall, but I think larger meetings were held in the library. This was a multi-purpose room. The lawyers, of course, worked to a large extent in the law library in the city.
Yes, it altogether sounds much more tranquil, and perhaps a period when you could get on with your work more than the period that followed. The 40s and 50s were a time of considerable ferment and indeed unhappiness, I think, in the University of Tasmania. Working up to the Royal Commission and then of course the subsequent Orr case, but you don't, you're not aware of any kind of undercurrents in the period you were there.
No, it was tranquil in the sense that I don't recall any major scandals, personal clashes, any more than normal financial problems. It was an uncertain period because between 1933 and 1938 we had the beginning of the Japanese move into Manchuria. We were conscious of the uncertainties of the world, and I've mentioned earlier the uncertainties of the totalitarian dictators, the war in Spain, the problems of Czechoslovakia. This gave a good deal of uncertainty to student life and thinking. And of course, the other great thing was the Depression. I said that I don't recall particularly